and guilty of murdering an Afghan fighter. The man was shot dead in Helmand province in September 2011. Two other Marines were acquitted at a court-martial in Wiltshire. Military analyst Colonel Mike Dewitt is confident this won't affect the reputation of the armed forces.
I think people are wise enough to understand that occasionally, under extreme circumstances, these things have happened, and they understand that the standards of the British Army and the Royal Marines are, in 99.9% of cases, very high, and people behave correctly.
The family of a three-year-old boy killed in a suspected hit-and-run in Darlington has appealed for the driver to hand himself in.
That's Tony sounding not too bad for change.
Danny Wake was walking with his mother, brother and another child when he was struck by a vehicle on Monday. His uncle, Scott Sherlock, has made this emotional appeal.
Our family want to appeal to the person who did or did this, or knows who did this, find it in their hearts to come forward so we can find the answers we need. Imagine if this was your little boy and how you would be feeling.
More than a million people have been forced to flee their homes after a super typhoon swept across the Philippines. Haiyan has left a trail of destruction, setting off landslides and triggering blackouts. So far, four people are known to have been killed. A bomb has been found under the car of a former police officer in East Belfast. Army technicians made what's described as the viable device safe. The country's biggest water company has been banned from putting up its prices by 8% to cover infrastructure costs and bad debts. The industry regulator Ofwat said the planned rise by Thames Water of almost £30 from next year was not justified. And the House Secretary is on course to become the richest member of the Cabinet. Jeremy Hunt's expected to make millions from the sale of an online business he set up before he became an MP. That's the latest. I'm Danny Crawshaw.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. And helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Clifton East and the Deputy Leader of the Lib Dem Group on Bristol City Council, Christian Martin. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, would the owner of a chain of cinemas or an insurance boss make a good chief constable? That's the latest wizard wheeze of the coalition government to improve policing. We find out what the local police federation think of the idea. Friends of the Earth will be here too. They will be sharing with us on the proposals to frack the Mendips, the latest on that, and our local Sino-Norman nuclear power station. This programme's recommended Christmas book is, without doubt, The Operators by US investigative journalist Michael Hastings. It's about his surreal experiences embedded with the US High Command in Afghanistan. He went on afterwards to accuse the Pentagon of being identical to the US mainstream journalists and of declaring war on politicians and independent media. In June this year, Michael Hastings died in a suspicious fiery car crash in his hometown of LA. So are the lines between the military and what we see and hear in our national newspapers too close for comfort? Is the national press, as Hastings suggested, becoming just an arm of the military? What do you ask if you want to fix an election? Or who do you ask if you want to fix an election or destroy an honest politician's reputation? Welcome to the secretive world of strategic communications. It's public relations on steroids. And we'll be hearing tonight from a former British Army psychological warfare officer. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius, some heavy showers this weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, light showers on Saturday, but sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, cloudy and some showers at the beginning of the week, sunny towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 16th and 17th of November, highs of 10 degrees Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is the councillor for Clifton East and deputy leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Christian Martin. Hi, Christian. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon.
So, first of all, Stephen Williams, your local MP. Christian, he voted for an attack on Syria. Is that going to backfire on him, do you think, when it comes to the next general election?
I couldn't possibly comment on that one, Tony.
How would you have voted?
It's a very tough issue, and obviously the newspaper and television images that we're getting almost on a daily basis at the moment
leave a lot. We have been for the last couple of years, and we'll be talking about that in part two.
Leave a lot to be desired, and are horrendous to look at. I don't know. We are obviously taking a more cautious approach given previous interventions.
I mean, there is some evidence that the BBC, for example, have been actually manipulating interviews. We'll be hearing about that in part two as part of the look at psychological warfare. Ultimately, the Lib Dem party, your deputy leader here in the city, is looking a bit grim for the next general election, mainly because, largely because of the what many people feel is a betrayal over tuition fees. I mean, the facts emerged, didn't they, after the general election, that a deal had been done between Nick Clegg and David Cameron that if they went into coalition, basically Clegg was going to go back on all his promises over what was going to happen with higher education.
I don't know about a deal was done. I mean, certainly there was a coalition agreement agreed, but there certainly wasn't a deal done. To be honest with you, I think there is something quite tedious about everybody repeatedly going on about the tuition fees. Everyone's got to remember the Labour Party instigated an inquiry into tuition fees under Lord Brown, who proposed £9,000 tuition fees. The coalition, yes, admittedly, took his recommendations. But it has to be remembered the Liberal Democrats didn't win the election. We didn't win a majority. And so therefore we couldn't put in place our manifesto. But out of the coalition agreement, we managed to negotiate considerably important areas of policy that affect and upheld some of the pledges and promises and parts of our manifesto from that election.
But one of the things we keep hearing, don't we, since 2008 and Gordon Brown saving the world, is that there's not enough money for anything. Who is really in charge, Christian? Is it the banks or the government that actually set the rules of the game?
I think we've asked this question before when I've been on here, and the bottom line for me is that I have absolutely no idea where the money's gone or where the money's coming from for us to fund half of the things that we seem to find the money to do, whilst decrying the fact that we don't have the money to do anything elsewhere. I don't know. I don't know where it's coming from. Is it all paper? Is it all paper money? Is it all generated by computers? I have no idea. I'm not an economist, so that might be a naive statement to make, but I don't know.
What's the Liberal Democrats' vision in the city at the moment then? I always try and ask this, and it was almost like it's taking a step back from things and saying, well, for many years the Liberal Democrat Party actually ran the administration here in Bristol. Now we're dealing with a different situation with a former Liberal Democrat councillor, George Ferguson, as an independent, in inverted commas, mayor. What is the Lib Dem Party's vision for the city, Christian?
Well, first of all, George was a Liberal, not a Liberal Democrat. So there is a slight distinction, and although we share certain ideology. And I must admit, I thought you were still talking about the City of London, but we're talking about the City of Bristol.
No, we've come down local, yeah.
We have come local. So what was the question? How's it all faring under George?
No, what's your vision as a party these days?
Well, I don't think that our vision has changed from what we were doing previously, which was to actually continue to with the green agenda that we had here for the City of Bristol. Let's not forget that report that came out, moneysupermarket.com, suggesting that Bristol is the best city in the country to live in, was predicated on the green credentials that were instilled in the city through under the last Liberal Democrat administration, and started, credit where credit's due, under the Labour former administration as well. So we continue to push that, continue with bringing jobs and stabilising and creating Opportunities for the creative industries in Bristol.
And, I mean, is Gary Hopkins into the green agenda? Because I seem to remember that he seemed to want to get little parcels of our public land and sell it off for housing developments.
Yeah, very misunderstood green space strategy, that. Very misunderstood. And a nice sort of pothole to try and trip me up on. What was actually going to happen there was we were going to sell off parcels of land that were not necessarily used by anybody. These were peripheral bits that were costing the council money to maintain because of health and safety, etc. No, health and safety. We're talking about some bits of land that were just wasteland with, you know, breeze blocks and rubbish in them. That was costing the taxpayer money to clear up and maintain or to fence off. And so that was going to be, some of those areas were going to be sold off in order to finance other parks. And in fact, we bought parks while we were the last administration. So
but you found that there was people who were using these bits of land, maybe even just for walking their dogs, that, you know, it caused uproar. I mean, it was one of the biggest things over the last 5-6 years that's actually got people out on the streets and in front of the council house protesting.
Well, I do remember it sort of reached its zenith as I came in after winning my election, and I thought, goodness me, what is this policy that we're that I'm scraping off the bottom of my shoe?
Did Gary explain it to you?
It became very clear very quickly, you know, what was going on. A lot of it was completely over-exaggerated and unnecessary criticism of what he was attempting to do. We were actually expanding and securing the green space that we had in Bristol by getting rid of unnecessary parcels of waste land, and that is it. That is, at its simplest, what happened.
Okay, tell us about your day job, if you have one. Do you?
I do have a day job.
I mean,
yes.
I don't know whether you think that councillors should have a day job. Do you? I mean, is it okay? Is it easy enough to carry on as a?
Well, let's put it this way. There was an audit done recently of the number of hours that councillors spend on councillor work during any one given month, and the average came out 140 hours a month. Well, councillors receive an allowance, not a salary, an allowance of £11,400 a year. When you
well, what's the difference, first of all, between an allowance and a salary?
Well, I think if we were salaried, they would be breaking the law. No, it's not tax-free. Of course not, we get taxed on it. But if we were salaried, they would be breaking the law at that level because we're earning considerably less than the minimum wage.
Oh, I see.
And so as an allowance, they can get away with...
So it's a way around the law.
I'm not saying that it's a way around the law. I'm just saying what is interesting is 140 hours a month on average councillors do for £11,400 allowance, less than the minimum wage. It's a hard job. But I have to fit into that a day job, which is what you were asking me about. My day job is I write screenplays, I make films, and I bread and butter is corporate videos.
Is there anything we can see of yours online then, on YouTube or something?
Yeah. There are plenty of films. A film called Shank, recent film that just came out on DVD in September called Cal. It's got lots of the riot footage actually that took place here in Bristol cut into the narrative.
Tell us a bit about that then.
Cal, it's about a young man who returns to the UK to seek redemption with his mother who's dying in hospital, and he's met by the full force of the economic crisis and Bristol City under siege from rioters.
What's the message you're trying to put across in these films? That is to say, I'm assuming that you have quite a lot of creative input in right from the start.
I do have a lot of creative. I mean, I wrote and directed that one, so it's very much an auteur film. In fact, if one were to view it, in fact, the critics have called it my most political film because there's a lot of left-leaning politics in it. The message is don't give up hope, basically, is the message in that film. And actually, it's funny how, you know, love triumphs. You know, it's a classic conceit. But love
okay,
triumphs.
Well, I'll find it online tonight, and we're on the show's page at www.thisweek.org.uk. I'll put a link into it later on this evening if people want to have a look.
Most kind.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what about this question about who's running things? Is it the banks or is it the government that we were talking about with Christian there?
I think it's fairly clear. I mean, we've had all this stuff about Russell Brand's revolution in the media in the last 10 days or so. I think it's fairly clear to a lot of people that elected politicians at any level are definitely playing second fiddle to forces which are stronger than they are. And some of the people's disillusion with mainstream politics is justified because of that. But of course, there's also the lazy, they're all the same, blah, blah, blah. That's just not true. As Christian's just pointed out, most local political activists and councillors, political activists like myself, do it all for nothing. He's doing it for less than minimum wage. And the idea that either he or I are somehow on the take is ridiculous. But of course, further up the food chain, there are people who are, for sure.
But
the top level of the political food chain is at the bottom level of the real food chain. The real food chain starts. But something like the Prime Minister earns less than most top civil servants while he's in office, like Tony Blair. But of course, once you leave office, your boots are filled.
Well,
less than the City Director of Bristol.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, we were talking about this last week, and in a bleak way, because we were talking about the last Saturday's Chartist convention. The Chartists were saying that they felt that it was very important that all MPs were paid, because it meant that the rich actually found it possible to become an MP, but the poor couldn't. What were your thoughts on that, Christian?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we only have to go back, not that far back in history, actually, to remind ourselves of all the rotten boroughs and how we had to repeal all of that, where people bought in to constituencies because they had the money and just went and sat in Parliament and changed the laws as they saw fit. You know, that's out of which, you know, we have a slightly more democratized world, but it's not the best outcome. But money definitely corrupts.
It does seem to me, Martin, that, you know, you've got this situation where the Chartists were very successful, but it was after the time where the enclosures and the land had been privatised. So once people didn't have actually anywhere to call their own home, they were having to pay rent or whatever, and it was at that point that they then got the vote. I mean, it would have been nicer for everyone to have a vote whilst they actually could make a decision about keeping somewhere to live.
In actual fact, the vote, the 1832 Act and the 1867 Act, it was basically you've got to be a property owner to vote. Yeah, it's like being a shareholder in the country. You've got to own something. And of course, we're kind of going back to that. And of course, many of the people who don't have any assets they exclude themselves by having such a negative. I mean, the real problem we have in Labour inner city wards is not people voting against us, it's people not wanting to vote at all. And they just won't, they don't actually get, you know, they don't see what their own best interests are. Even in Britain, where the process has not gone so far, I was just reading earlier today, 73% of MPs are millionaires in Britain. In the UK, in the US, I don't suppose there's anybody in the Congress or the Senate who isn't a multimillionaire. And that is the reality.
Well,
that's the reality.
Let's just hope we don't go further down the US route. Anyway, this week's news, Universal Credit Scheme will waste at least £140 million, say MPs. Now, this money, Christian, is just what's been written off from the digital or software program this week. Now, you know, just sitting down with a couple of calculations, that would provide 10,000 jobs, not amazingly well-paid jobs, but 10,000 public service basic jobs for a year. And that's just the money that's been written off this week on this universal credit program.
Shocking is all I can say. It's another example of a government department deciding that they're going to do something quite extreme and significant in their opinion or in their eyes in terms of the need for computer programs that take forward the policy that they want to enact, that fails because nobody's tested it and huge amounts of money are wasted. But inherent within the problem of this money that has been lost is the fact that there were so many lax protocols in who could and couldn't spend money. I mean, in this, you know, one of the articles, it talks about a secretary was allowed to authorise purchase orders worth £23 million. I mean, how was that allowed to happen? How were there not caps? I know at the council, for example, there are caps on what senior management are allowed to spend. They have to then go and get authorisation. How does someone manage to spend £23 million without being authorised?
We're getting quite close to misconduct in public office, aren't we? If someone is saying, well, I am actually in charge of this, but I'm not going to take any responsibility for it. That's what we've had with Ian Duncan Smith this week, blaming his secretary for the this waste of money.
Well, I'm not saying that I sympathise at all with Duncan Smith whatsoever, but knowing the way that the civil service works on a more microcosmic local level, you know, I can understand that there probably and possibly were failings within the structures for how certain things should have been done. I note, which is very interesting, that this is probably one of the first times I've read in a newspaper article the naming of senior civil servants who are being put forward to take the blame on this. I mean, we're told repeatedly not to blame or to publicly name and shame council officers that fail in their duties, and not to criticise them publicly. And yet here we have civil servants at government level who are being criticised publicly, and their heads should roll, surely.
Martin, what are your thoughts about Ian Duncan Smith on this one, particularly because, you know, one would have thought that if he's in charge, he should at least shoulder the blame. He's not. He's saying it's all my secretary's fault.
Well, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, frankly, the problem is that Ian Duncan Smith hasn't thought this through before from the get-go, and it's very difficult for civil servants to make a pig to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. The concept of universal credit in principle might work if you were going to do like they're having a referendum in Switzerland, and the Cypriot government are now talking about having basically a citizen's income, which has been discussed in Labour liberal circles for many years and in Green circles. And of course the beauty of that is you just give people the money. You set the computer up, as long as they can, I would suggest they've got to show that they voted in the last election if they want to have it. Everybody just gets it, and it's basically that replaces all of the other benefits. So the idea of putting everything in one pot is quite potentially.
But where's the incentive for people to go to work if you do that? Then?
Well, the incentive is quite straightforward. If you are ill, sick, or you don't want to work at the moment because you've got mental health issues, you just live on your benefit. But of course, you can go out and get an hour's work, 2 hours work. You can be a local councillor, for example, etc. You know, it just flexibilises everything. And the other thing it does, of course, is it just calms everybody down. This is why they bring it in Cyprus, because people are panicking that they're just going to be allowed to fall down the drain.
Anyway, Christian, what are your
thoughts? I haven't quite finished yet, because what's making the problem here is they've got to recalculate the benefit every time people do an hour's work, and that's why the computer system has got to be so complicated. Yeah, it's complicated because it's a complex idea. He won't accept that you just give people the money. Therefore, you've got to recalculate it every time any individual does an extra hour's work. They've got to recalculate the whole thing.
You made your point. What about this, Christian? I mean, because whilst you're suggesting there, it sounds to me as if there wouldn't be a lot of incentive on people to actually go to work.
Well, let's just step back a second, though, and go back to what we were talking about with regards to Duncan Smith. You know, I personally believe, the way the system is set up is that the civil servants would have actually worked up this policy before they decided to proceed with it. So there would have been internal modelling that they would have done and years of analysis before they'd even presented it to the incoming government as an idea, regardless of whether the fact, you know, Duncan Smith prior to the election had the idea or had looked at the paperwork or not. So somewhere there has been a failing by the civil service in the money that's been wasted.
Well, I would imagine that maybe the civil servants came back to them back in 2010 and said, we can't do this, and they said, you will do it.
Well, then we need to have that, you know, someone needs to do a freedom of information to actually find out whether that's the case or not. But it does feel to me that somewhere in this mix, civil servants have screwed up, and I'm not saying that I feel sympathetic at all towards Duncan Smith or any empathy for his situation. He is in charge of that department. He should be leading it. You know, he should have his eye on this, and he should get his senior civil servants to answer to him.
Well, should he still be leading it after this disaster?
Well, no one's heads ever seem to roll in these things. It's just money that we seem to fritter away, and we're expected just to sit here and take it. Yeah, maybe he should lose his job. Maybe we should have an example.
Martin?
Well, I think he should lose his job, but also from a political tactical point of view, let's just keep him there and kick the hell out of him.
That's a little bit cruel, Martin.
I'm afraid it is. He's been a bit cruel to the rest of the people on the breadline. We're going to be cruel to him.
I hope you're talking figuratively. But what do you mean cruel? He's trying to motivate people to work.
No, he's not. He went to Easter House in 2010 and said, oh gosh, isn't it awful? It's the first time he'd ever been in a hardcore inner city area. Isn't this awful? I know what I'm going to have to do for these people. I'm going to have to cut all their benefits. And that's exactly what's happening. If you go to Easter House, you'll hear a lot more than they'll put it in a different way than the way I'm putting it.
Five disabled people this week won an independent living fund appeal. This is the Court of Appeal judges saying the government have breached equality duty by failing to properly assess the impact of abolishing the independent living fund. This is Patrick Butler in The Guardian on Wednesday. Five disabled people won their attempt to overturn the government's abolition of the £300 million fund that helps severely disabled people to live a full life in the community. Christian, again, it looks like the government have been caught out here actually breaking the law.
Yes, it does. I mean, again, I would suggest that this might be a classic case of them rushing forward with a policy without it being tested out properly. You know, it's reminiscent of the girl that took them to court over the internships, or being forced to go and work at Poundland whilst on the dole, you know, and that not being tested out properly. This has greater impact and is more significant, not more significant, but equally significant, because of the people that we're talking about who are directly affected by it. It is interesting. I don't know how again did the civil service miss the equalities impact on this. You know, it is part of the legislation. It should have been adhered to. It should have been considered. I don't understand how this could be such a significant cock-up.
Martin, the Independent Living Fund helps 18,500 severely disabled people in Britain to hire a carer or personal assistant to provide round-the-clock care on occasions, and to enable them to work and live independent lives. The government proposed the Independent Living Fund be scrapped, and they've been apparently, no, it can't be now.
Yeah, well, I understand that civil servants have to be held to account, but I think an awful lot of what's going on here is civil servants in the old days would turn round to ministers and say, look, we're not doing this, you don't know what you're talking about. But of course, they have been disciplined, and now what we've got is a lot of amateurs actually in charge of benefit policy in this country, who've never lived on benefits, they know nobody who does live on benefits. They've never worked the system. They don't understand how the system works, which is why they come up with such unworkable ideas. And basically, the civil servants that I think they've been put in an impossible position, being asked to do stupid things.
600,000 job seekers allowance claimants have had their benefits docked since the new rules took effect in June.
Yeah.
The government's revealed London Job Centre. The figures suggest there are likely to be about 100,000 more claimants sanctioned annually under the new regime. Martin. This is job seekers allowance, and the benefit sanctions basically mean that I think it's the first stage is something like 3 weeks, and the second stage something like 2 months, that you get no benefits at all. I mean, what are people supposed to do if there's actually no money coming in whatsoever?
Well, for now they're going to food banks, and there is a mood.
Well, how do
of,
you pay? Yeah, I mean, you well, can the, get your housing benefit.
The mood amongst people at the bottom level in this society, in which at the moment I include myself, is one of sullen defiance. People really fed up with all of this, and you know, we're at every turn we're being frustrated. I, for example, have been kicked out of my house because the council came round and said it needed improvement. My landlord says you've got to go. At the same time, I've got to apply for 10 jobs a week, which I'm just about managing to do. But a lot of the people I see in the same situation as me haven't got my cultural resources, and they can't apply for 10 jobs a week even if they wanted to. They can't read.
The thing is that there aren't the number of jobs going around.
And of course, what's really worrying,
people are being denied jobs and they're being blamed.
What really worries me about this is that the focus groups, particularly in the swing constituencies which will win the next election, are lapping all this up, which is why the government is coming out with all of this sort of anti-poor, anti-disabled people prejudice. But that's because it represents a kind of thinking in the mainstream society. If it was just the government doing it, then we would feel fed up and people would be angry, but at least they would know. But it's actually worse than that. It's a socially divisive situation is developing, where those who are losing are getting bitter and frustrated, and those who are in somewhat slightly better off are blaming those below them rather than those at the people at the top.
Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Christian Martin, and Esther McVeigh, the Work Minister, claimed these people getting their benefits docked for missing job centre appointments were deliberately avoiding finding a job.
It's inflammatory language, but you know, I think that it's been identified, and I don't share necessarily Martin's view on everything that he's just said, and I'm surprised that he has been thrown out of his council house whilst there.
It's not a council house, it's private rented.
Your private rented company? Yeah. No, the council have said you've got to do it up.
No, they've come and said to my landlords they've got to do it up, and they've decided can't be bothered, let's just kick him out and sell it.
Okay, well, I'm surprised about that. But just going back to what Esther was saying, yes, it's inflammatory, but we do have, and there have been plenty of instances and examples of people that have, you know, ripped off the welfare state, but equally there are a huge swathes of people that are deserving of that safety net and
social security.
Yeah, the social security, but it's a parachute, you know, that's there for a purpose. But you also have the evidence of the people that have unfortunately lost their jobs in this last recession, who all talk about the need to feel like they're doing something every day. And, you know, if this has to be a little bit of a stick over a carrot, it might help some people feel a little bit better about looking for work.
Do you want to? Does it make you feel any better?
No, I think as somebody who's been in and out of, I've been in and out of the benefits system all my life, because I'm a sort of community activist type worker, and you know, the funding is always short term, so you're never on a full contract. So I've seen the system work. Actually, I'm sending off 10 CVs a week to employers who will immediately delete them, because in actual fact it's not serious. And I actually haven't got time to apply for proper jobs, because I'm being told to do all this silly stuff. And the people I'm dealing with in the benefit office know exactly what's going on. They know it's rubbish. I know it's rubbish.
But I remember this rhetoric from the 1980s when I was a student. You know, and everyone talked about, you know, challenging the Tories to go and live on the unemployment benefit, as was at the time. You know, and if you look at the figures today versus the figures then. To my mind, they don't seem to have shifted that much.
I mean, there was the latest one of these things this week, which was, I think it was Newcastle, somewhere up in the northeast. A job in a supermarket, 1,000 people applied for it, Christian. I mean, there just simply aren't the jobs there for all these people, and yet the people who can't get those jobs that aren't there are being blamed.
Well, there again, as there were examples of people that have been ripping off the benefit system, and thankfully they're very few. I don't buy the numbers that the Conservatives like to present as being, you know, endemic within the welfare state. I don't believe that there are that many. But equally, you know, in the last couple of years, we have managed to create jobs. There has been a resurgence in the economy of late.
Well, I would say people at Westminster would probably disagree with you. So let's go to Westminster there, Christian. Sorry to interrupt you, but
who's disagreeing with me?
well, we shall see.
We put a million people into work.
This is short-term jobs is what they say, and
the population's increased,
and also things like these zero-hour contracts. So people aren't actually getting enough money to pay the bills, even though they are in work. So anyway, let's go to Westminster. The little exchange between Ed and Dave this week. I'm a bit frustrated with Ed Miliband, because he gets something like 6 questions, I think, isn't it? Prime Minister's question. He seems to ask the same question again and again and again. The idea, I suppose, is to drill the point home. But he does this every week, it seems. And this week, he was concentrating on the National Health Service.
Over 2,000 people have been made redundant. The Honourable Gentleman says it's rubbish. It's absolutely true. A parliamentary answer from one of the health ministers. 2,000 people made redundant and rehired, diverting money from the front line as this Prime Minister sacks nurses. Well, the Prime Minister seems to be saying it's untrue. Well, if he gets back, he can tell me whether it's untrue. And we know why the NHS is failing. His botched reorganisation, the abolition of NHS Direct, cuts to social care, and 6,000 fewer nurses. There's only one person responsible for the A&E crisis, and that's him.
We have taken 20,000 administrators out of the NHS, and I'm not going to take lectures from a government that saw patients drinking out of...
Order! 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 Members are shouting at the tops of their voices at the Prime Minister, and they must stop doing so. The Prime Minister.
Let me give him the facts about the NHS under this government. Mixed-sex accommodation down by 98%. 1.2 million more people treated in A&E. 500,000 more inpatient. We're doing all of that, and we're not following Labour's advice, which was to cut the NHS. That's the truth under this government. The NHS getting better. Labour would have cut it, and Labour never stand up for the NHS.
Now, Christian, your thoughts there. I mean, obviously, it was a bit of a bolshy exchange there, but what Ed's saying is that because there's so many failings across the NHS at the moment, a lot of pressure is being put onto the accident and emergency departments, and he's worried that over the winter there really is going to be a crisis in A&E when A&E just simply cannot deal with the quantity of people who are turning up desperately needing help.
I've read those same articles, but I think it's interesting in what Ed was saying there about 2,000 people that were fired and then rehired. He didn't identify who they were or what level, or whether they were management, whether they were nurses, so on and so forth. They might well have been fired to only be rehired through, you know, a different system or in a different part of the NHS. We don't know. A&E, there is a crisis, that's quite clear. But in real terms, the same amount of money, if not more, has been going into the NHS under the coalition government. You know, the coalition government has tried to bring spending under control within the NHS. Let's not forget, you know, Labour were throwing money at the NHS because they felt that was the way to plug the hole or to plug the gap. It didn't work, you know, and now we're having to draw in and restrain spending and put it where it's needed, into patients. And a consequence of that is, yes, some departments and some areas of the NHS suffer. Resources, I'm sure, will be ring-fenced and re-diverted into A&E now that this crisis has been identified.
I've just got one thing to say to that. No top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service. Read my lips, said David Cameron when he was standing for election the last time we got a chance to vote against him. No top-down reorganisation of the National Health Service. Now, an awful lot of what's going on in the benefits system and the health service and all the rest of it, as anybody who works in the civil service will tell you, the real problem is people who want to improve things. We've actually got a system here that works. We've worked out how to make it work, and then you come along and say, we know how you know how to make it work, but we're going to change it all completely.
But hang on a second. Sorry, Martin, to interrupt you. You know, let's go back to the previous point about JSA. You know, the Labour Party did not make it attractive for people to go out and get work when they were handing out so much money in tax credits.
All right, tax credits are still there, of course. Lots of people in work are, in fact, on benefits.
Yeah, but the other day, the irony is, the other day I heard somebody talk about the fact that they'd lost their tax credits because the money that they were taking home after tax had gone up as a consequence of the tax-free threshold that we have increased under this coalition government. And the point is, yeah, you may be getting less tax credit, but your tax... Your money after tax has gone up.
Okay, Christian, let him answer.
The problem is that... If you try and change any system, this is a general problem, not just about JSA or about the National Health Service, is that if you, and we're going to hear from the police in the second hour of this, the Police Federation, about the changes that the government is trying to force on them. Frontline doctors, police officers, probation officers, Royal Mail workers, they obviously don't know nothing. So somebody can just walk in and say, we're going to change all of this, even though you've been doing it this way for a very long time. And usually systems have developed through trial and error. Yeah. I mean, I know the people I deal with.
So Labour were right, were they? No, they handed all that money to the doctors and gave them six-figure salaries.
Wrong. They were wrong. They messed it up.
Yeah, so we're now trying to undo what they got wrong.
No, all right, you're not,
in order to ensure that there's more money going into the system.
I'm sure we'll find common ground on this. I'm not trying to make part of
the point. I know, and I'm not
trying to. I mean, the point is that we just talked earlier about citizens' income. Now, what happens when the financial system is run by criminals? And we've had former Met fraud squad officer Rowan Bosworth Davis on this show saying it's not some of the people at the top who are criminals, it's all of them. And he specifically mentioned Hargreaves Lansdowne in this particular city. He said they're all criminals. Now, when you have a crash which brings the whole world economy down, you deal with that by putting the criminals in prison, and then there's a time for radical thinking. So, in actual fact, we're never going back to full employment. That's in the 1960s. Not going to happen. That's why we need a citizen's income. That's what the Greens have been saying all along. And if we had PR, they'd be nibbling away at our left wing, and they'd be nibbling away at your left wing. And in actual fact, the Liberals used to believe in citizen's income, and this kind of we're going to punish the poor attitude, that's not 21st century. And of course, the place where, I'll just finish on this, the place where they didn't dare to bring in the poll tax or the community charge, and where they still have very, very good council housing, they still have the rates. You know where that is? Northern Ireland. Because eventually, the provisional IRA got the British government to understand, you think you're going to save money by cutting benefits for our people, but in actual fact you have to build prisons, you have to double the police force, and eventually, of course, they get the message. And of course, we've only had one round of rioting so far, but of course when the crash comes, as it probably will in the new year, it's going to make New York look like Bogota, and it's going to make Bristol look like Brixton, and Brixton's going to look more like the Bronx, and that's how it's going to be.
Okay, back to Westminster, and on a sort of similar subject to this, equality gap in Britain is the greatest we hear since World War II. This is David Winnick at Prime Minister's Questions.
David Winnick! John Scott.
One of the domestic objectives of the last war, the Second World War, was to bring about a fairer society in Britain. And is he aware how wrong it is that the Chancellor and himself, who've never had any form of financial insecurity, should now be pursuing policies which hit out at the most hard-pressed, the most vulnerable, the people in our society, millions of them, many of them low-paid, who find it so difficult to feed and clothe their children? What is happening is totally unacceptable, and I find it contemptible.
Yes. But what I would say to the Honourable Gentleman is that we have taken 2.4 million of the poorest people in our country out of income tax altogether. And I have to say to him that the figures simply don't fit with the story he's trying to tell. The facts are inequality is at its lowest level since 1986. Fact. Pupil premium is directing more money to the poorest children in our schools. Fact. Applications from disadvantaged children to universities has gone up, not down. Fact. There are fewer workless households. 400. I'm keen to answer the question, Mr. Speaker, and it's a very direct answer. Yes. Workless households down by 425,000. Payday lending regulated properly for the first time. And yes, a proper consultation on zero-hours contracts. Those are the actions that we are taking to build a fairer country. And instead of complaining about them, he should be backing them.
Christian Martin, Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council. Your thoughts on that? Because we're getting two completely different figures there on the equality gap. We've got David Winnick saying it's the worst since 1945, and then David Cameron saying it's the least since 1986.
96. I think for some it would be difficult to accept what David Cameron is saying. But I don't think that some of what he was saying should be written off as being factually incorrect, because we have obviously narrowed the gap. And he identified pupil premium, he identified the tax threshold, he identified...
So are you saying we're living in a more equal society, say, than we were 20 years ago now?
I think it's slightly more equitable than under the Labour Party, where Tony Blair said that he was not interested in making David Beckham pay any more tax. You know, and that was the society that he stood for. At least we're trying to crack down on some of the tax loopholes that Labour just ignored.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not going to defend the last Labour government, far from it. I think the real problem is that from a macroeconomic point of view, whether you have people on benefits which you're cutting, or you force real wages down, which is what's happening in all over the Western world, not just in Britain. Real wages are being constantly forced down. That wasn't possible even in the 1980s. Trade unions and the cultural inertia didn't allow the cutting of real wages. Now, the problem with this is that it's a road to nowhere. Ask the Greeks. You can carry on cutting, and what actually happens? But the growth in the economy now is a property bubble in the southeast of England. It's the same old, same old, same old. The figures showed, I think, in the last quarter, that we got 14,000 people less in manufacturing industry and 77,000 new estate agents. And of course, these are the people who in the swing constituent. This comes back to the electoral system, Christian. All of the political parties, major political parties, need to win Basildon, Harlow on a first-past-the-post ticket. And that means that the pea brains of the swing voters in those constituencies are what determine policy.
Well, the thing that makes me laugh is that the last general election, the Liberal Democrats proposed a mansion tax on properties worth more than £1 million. Mm-hmm. That we considered to be a fair and equitable policy. The Labour Party, under Miliband, proposed that it should be a threshold of £2 million. I find it coincidental that his Miliband's house in London is worth £1.9 million. Uh-huh. You know, so where is their real attempt to bring equality about in this country? I don't see it. I don't hear it. And it's certainly not there within their policies. The one thing that you and I will probably see eye to eye on is, I think, the pay gap is absolutely outrageous in this country. The rich at the top are earning far too much money. The way that they earn that money is absolutely outrageous. And in many instances, it's immoral. But then I think the people that actually allow them to do that, that are elected by us to legislate so that they don't run away with themselves, are also to blame, because they should be doing more to actually stop those ridiculous sums of money that they're earning, which would actually probably help the system, help... avoid or certainly head off another crash or another disaster that you know that you and I will end up paying for.
Okay, Bristol North West MP Charlotte Leslie also featured up at Westminster at Prime Minister's Questions this week. She was talking about Bristol Rovers and the rather annoyed about a judicial review into their new stadium.
Charlotte Leslie!
Judicial reviews can be valuable for communities to have their say. Is the Prime Minister taking to prevent what is happening in Bristol, where a small unrepresentative group are using judicial review, costing the local taxpayer thousands, which is preventing the building of a badly needed stadium for Bristol Rovers Football Club, which Bristolians badly want, and which will bring game-changing benefits to our city?
Yeah. Well, I know that my honourable friend has been campaigning very hard and relentlessly to provide Bristol Rovers with the ground that they need, and I commend her for that. Obviously, there has been an issue with judicial reviews, and these play a role, of course, in holding government to account, but I share her frustration that judicial review has become something of an industry, and we do need to fix that, and we've taken a series of steps to try and do that.
Christian, are you happy with the judicial review industry, and what are your thoughts about the Bristol Stadium and the Rovers Stadium?
Well, obviously everybody is getting their knickers in a twist and creating a brouhaha over the fact that there is a cost implication in judicial review. But judicial reviews are also there as a check and balance that decisions that have been made have been the right ones. And they are the general public, i.e. the taxpayers' democratic right to call a judicial review if they... if collectively there's enough of them that don't actually believe that that decision was taken in their best interests. So it's a difficult one to argue against, I think. However, with regards to the Bristol Rovers football ground, my understanding is from colleagues and from those that sat on that planning committee, there is overwhelming support from the residents for that supermarket to be built in order for Bristol Rovers to be able to go and build a new stadium. I see no reason why that shouldn't proceed. That's what the public want.
I mean, isn't this just a sort of a cheap property deal where they want to build their new stadium on a cheap bit of land, they've got their planning permission there. It's just that they need to be able to get permission to sell off the old stadium for a massive amount of money to build houses. These planning deals are often, there's a lot of money at stake, isn't there? And I mean, certainly if you look at City, I'm not sure about the financial state of Bristol Rovers. Sometimes these clubs, don't survive unless they do these dodgy planning deals.
Well, you have to be careful when you say dodgy planning deal, because it has nothing to do with planning per se. You know, your question implies that the planning committee potentially made a decision on commercial grounds. It didn't. It has to make those decisions within very defined laws and governed by very, you know, serious rules. So it had nothing to do with the value at the end of the day.
The argument
obviously
is that the new
planning permission that was granted for a supermarket to be built there made it more valuable to the club in order to afford them the opportunity to go and build a new stadium.
A new Sainsbury's would suck out a lot of the potential spend from Gloucester Road and also create a tremendous amount of traffic in an area which isn't really equipped for it.
Certainly, I'm not hearing that from residents that have protested in favour of the supermarket. I mean, let's not forget, I have openly come out on the record opposing supermarket creep along the high street in certain parts of the city. But there are parts of the city that are crying out for supermarkets, and they bring a rebirth to communities where they are actually built. And up there at the top end of Gloucester Road, the residents want a big supermarket.
Martin,
and who are we to stand in the way of that progress that they want?
Martin, what are your thoughts about this whole deal up in North Bristol there?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm agnostic about it because I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion. And therefore, Christian puts his mind to these kind of questions all the time. That's what local councillors do. I'm not a local councillor. What I would say about the economics of football clubs, though, what's happened all over the world, if you look at Man United, when Glazer took it over on a leveraged buyout from America, totally opposed by the fans, he managed to buy it out, and now it's loaded down with debt and in real trouble, like Rangers have crashed and burned as a result of all of this. And of course, the alternative to this is what they've got in Barcelona, where the Barcelona Football Club is a social enterprise owned by the people of Barcelona.
Yeah,
nobody can take it over.
Yep.
That's the sort of model we need to think about.
Yep. Okay, well, we also this week had the amazing spectacle of all of the top bosses of the security services, GCHQ, MI5 and MI6, in front of an open session-ish of the Intelligence and Security Committee, chaired by former Conservative Defence Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who's also an advisor to a defence contractor. One of the most interesting questions, why has this budget for these security services grown since the Cold War? One would have thought it should have shrank. And Sir Malcolm Rifkin put that to the heads of, I think it was to the head of MI5.
Andrew Parker, you might like to answer. At the end of the Cold War, a lot of people thought, well, we can now reduce the size and cost of our intelligence agencies. In fact, it's gone the other way. They're far greater, larger and more expensive than they've ever been. Do you, as head of one of our intelligence agencies, a very secret agency, but also as a citizen, do you ever sometimes get nervous that our intelligence agencies are too strong, too powerful?
Well, you're asking both about scale and about powers, if I could take them in that order. At scale, £2 billion is a substantial amount of taxpayers' money, and we take our responsibilities in spending it extremely seriously, and that's closely overseen by this committee and audited by the National Audit Office. The scale of it is, of course, set by ministers against the backdrop of the whole of public spending. That £2 billion is equivalent to roughly 6% of the nation's defence budget. And so at that scale, we would contend and believe, and ministers clearly have been persuaded, that that is a proportionate investment against the threats the country faces. As far as dealing with the powers question, of course, the suggestion that somehow what we do is somehow compromising freedom and democracy, of course, we believe the opposite to be the case, and it's for this committee to oversee. The work we do is addressing directly threats to this country, to our way of life, to this country, and to people who live here. And the work we do is proportionately judged against the necessity of protecting against those threats.
That's Andrew Parker there, the Director General of MI5. Martin, he's talking about protecting against threats to this country, but then there is also the question, do some of the security services themselves present a threat when they're undermining, in some cases anyway, undermining this whole basic idea of if you need to go to a judge and get a warrant if you want to tap somebody's phone?
Well, I think a former Labour minister, his name now escapes me, said the other day, when they came forward with the snoopers charter, we knocked it back. But it turns out that they're doing it anyway, and they're coming forward for retrospective justification by the politicians for what they're doing already. And that sends alarm bells ringing for the most moderate-minded people. Hang on a minute, they're breaking the law already. They were told not to do it, and they're already doing it. I would also go further and say, what I would say to all three of the chaps standing there, is, I say, tell me about Operation Cyclone. And they say, what? I say, Operation Cyclone. You remember when we set up the Islamic International Brigades to fight in Afghanistan to drive the Soviets out. It was MI6 who were the lead agency on it from the CIA. It was the biggest secret operation in history. And from it was spawned Al-Qaeda, which you claim has now gone rogue and you can't control it. Do you know what? I'm a cynical sort of person. Hung around with a lot of Irish Republicans. I don't believe you. I think you still control it.
Okay.
And in actual fact, the police in Italy, I've got to make this point, Tony. The head of the Italian Supreme Court is a guy called Fernando Imposimato. So what I would say to these three chaps is, right, tell me about Imposimato. He's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. What's he saying? He wrote a book last year. What's in that book? In that book, he says that it's quite clear that all the terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s was carried out by NATO intelligence services with the Americans and the British in the lead role. How does he know that? After 30 years investigation by the Italian police force.
Okay, Christian, do you think we're getting value for money? £2 billion a year for these guys. And it's increased since the end of the Cold War, not decreased. I find that a little bit peculiar.
Well, £2 billion actually doesn't sound like a lot to me, considering what they have to actually do on our behalf in terms of securing our freedoms, especially in light of the fact that one of the first things that David Cameron did when he came into power was he destroyed all of those aeroplanes that the Defence Department was working on at a cost of, what was our research and development on those, £8 or 9 billion?
That's, I mean, right, when you, Harriers, it,
yeah,
sold off.
Yeah, exactly. So when you start putting it in comparison to the intelligence service trying to protect us, it doesn't seem like a very huge amount of money. Not,
okay,
again, when you're looking at $62 billion for HS2, which I'm ardently opposed
well, let me,
to.
Let me stop you there, but, because, I mean, because Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol this week to ask you what you think of our intelligence services, and particularly since the Snowden revelations.
Is Edward Snowden a threat to UK national interest or servant to the public?
I don't know anything about Edward Snowden. I think, unfortunately, government generally and members of Parliament mislead the country all the time. I think that's a fact of life, and we just have to live with that. That we elect the government, but unfortunately, whichever party is in power, they do their own thing. And I think they tend to ignore what the populace want. So I think it's one of those things that we have to learn to live with.
What he's doing is he's outlining some of the things. He's making the Secret Service look silly, but they ought to look silly if they can leave information lying about on computers, which is hackable. I don't have an opinion about whether he's a threat to the UK or whether he's not, but I would think that it's embarrassing for the government to have him go on the internet and tell everyone what's going on. I think it's quite amusing, really. I also think that GCHQ is essential for the safety of this country, particularly with Al-Qaeda and a lot of other things. So on the other hand, I do think the services do a lot for our country, and I agree with their, if you like, impartiality. I think what's the business of the government isn't illegal, so neither are at fault, but it's interesting that the point has been brought to the services, who, by their very nature, should keep things secret.
He should never have released them, because we all know in the background that things are being done for our security, and by spies and everything else. It's gone on since the year dot. So people aren't really ignorant of it, but they don't need it highlighting, especially in today's circumstances, because of terrorism. You know, there's people who just are insane, the sort of things they would carry out. You don't need to encourage them.
How do you rate the security service?
I don't know an awful lot about the security service, but I would rate them pretty highly in terms of the job they're supposed to be doing, which is protecting the country from terrorists. I don't think you need to be listening into private phone calls to do that job, to be honest.
I think there's a lot behind the scenes that we don't know about, and I think they do a tremendous job for the country. A friend of mine actually works for GCHQ. I don't know about his business. He works in computers and he works at Cheltenham, and I joke with him and stuff, but he certainly doesn't tell me anything about anything. So generally, it's a watertight system, I would say. Britain would do well to continue in the same vein. I think just because something's brought to people's attention just makes it more apparent. And mistakes were made. I don't believe anything is perfect. But I would agree that the GCHQ can listen to any phone call of mine. I'm not worried. And they can have what information they want. I'll only tell them good stuff anyway.
Bearing in mind we live in an open country, I don't think they're doing too bad a job, because they've protected the majority of the citizens up to now. We've only had relatively few big problems, like in London, 7-7 and all the rest of it, but because without them, we wouldn't have a free country.
I've got to say, my one overriding image is of them shooting that Brazilian guy on the tube a number of years ago, and let's just shoot him anyway kind of thing almost, and they're just awful. They've got a very difficult job, I guess, but that's why they're paid so highly, I'm sure, and so they have to get it right.
Do you mind if GCHQ is listening to your phone calls?
No, I would strongly object to that, yes. My private phone calls are my business, and I wouldn't want anyone listening to what I'm saying to someone privately. So whether I'm doing that by email or over the telephone, I don't think anyone has got the right to listen in. If they do, they're committing an offence as far as I'm concerned.
No, it's fine. I'm sure they do.
I'd rather that option, yes. I don't see a problem with that, no.
Well, no, because I've got nothing to worry about. If I've got anything private to say, then I would say it to the person direct. I wouldn't say it over the phone, so that's the safest way, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mind about that. Problems with it,
yeah,
yes.
It really annoys me, because it's private. I don't want no one listening to my conversations. I just keep changing my phone number. That's what I do. Jen, we changed it today, we both did.
Yeah.
I don't like people listening to our conversations.
I'm not overly fussed by that, but I guess I've not really got anything to hide.
Okay, sorry we don't have time for some comments from Martin and Christian there. Thanks to this week's guests, Councillor for Clifton East and Deputy Leader of the Lib Dem Group and Bristol City Council, Christian Martin. See you after the news.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
from the Sky News Centre at 6. A Royal Marine's facing life in jail after being found guilty of murdering a wounded Afghan fighter.